Hi everyone, Ian Gardner here. I have another awesome guest for you today, Steve Finelli. He is the CEO and founder of Drive Yellow. This is a platform for last mile delivery. And I guess it's best described as part software, part logistics, but this is less about the software and the business than it is really about Steve. But I've known Steve for years. He was really part of the startup ecosystem with me and many others back in the early 2000s when there was no real ecosystem. I wanted to get Steve on. He's got an amazing story of resilience and tenacity and talent and leadership. He's passionate. He's very open. He's not afraid to show vulnerability. And, you know, I love this. It's such a strength in a leader. He's also been part of Innovation Based Summit community for, you know, that's our group for late stage founders. He's been in there for a couple of years and he has been an amazing addition to this group. Look, this is a great interview. It's a great story. And I really hope you enjoy it. Here's Steve. All right. Welcome. We are here actually in my living room. This is the first time my living room, come kitchen, come office, has been turned into a studio. Steve Finelli is here with me. So Steve, thanks for coming all the way over to Bondi Junction.
No, not too far at all. Thanks yeah. for having me.
Yeah, you know, you're kind of a local, eastern suburbs boy, down
Maroubra.
Yeah.
In the bra.
Well, we are out of lockdown, which is fantastic news. You're double vaxxed and we can officially hang out.
Yeah, I know. It's exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I've been waiting for this moment for ages because I so prefer doing face-to-face. I mean, I think I'm pretty good now at working out how to do the technical stuff and run Zoom, and we're using Riverside as our podcast tool, but face-to-face can't beat.
So. Absolutely.
So Steve, you are currently CEO and founder at Drive Yellow. I think a few people may have seen their delivery drivers around, but maybe just before we get into your background, what you're doing, like, tell us a bit about Drive Yellow and where it's at.
Yeah, sure. We position ourselves as the intelligence layer between retailers and the gig economy. So we want to, our mission is to become the smartest gig economy management platform to help retailers provide the service that everyone wants, particularly these days, right? You know, the last 2 years, seen massive growth in getting things delivered and, yep. and the demand for convenience in general. So that's what we do. We provide the technology as well as assist retailers in getting in engaging with gig economy workers. I've been doing that for 7 years.
But is it just the technology? I mean, you're not really employing the drivers. I mean, again, that's a separate question. Yeah. Are they employees or not? But I mean,
definitely not employees. Let's make that really clear.
I'm sure we'll touch on that. Yeah, but so who's actually engaging them then?
Yeah, so we're basically retailers are posting jobs onto our platform. It's not dissimilar to the Airtaskers of the world. They're posting jobs, whether they be for shifts or for single deliveries or for runs. They can actually just use our technology as a software as a service platform on its own and use their own drivers if they want to. So we give them plenty of flexibility around how they can engage with either their own workforce or through people they book on through the platform.
Yeah.
And then drivers and couriers sign up. They have to go through the usual, jump through the usual hoops that you have to do in any gig economy platform to get signed up and ready to go. And then, you know, we're working with some of the biggest retailers in Australia, which is pretty exciting. You know, Woolworths, Coles and BWS and EB Games.
So if I order a bottle of whiskey from BWS,
we'll be one of the guys. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
You'll get it probably within 1 to 2 hours tops, you know. So, I mean, BWS have a guarantee of 1 hour. I think it's 1 hour at the moment. And we help them do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty much.
That's awesome. All right, we'll jump back into that because that is a seven-year journey, which is pretty fascinating. But I want to jump back. I mean, I've known you for, it must be 15 years now, I think.
At least.
Yeah.
20-odd years, I think.
Yeah. you know, I can often remember people from when I first met them and you were in the mass media office and mm-hmm. – Yeah, anyway, I had my video platform and you were doing, you know, there's a lot of people in the office. I remember that. But even further back, I mean, let's go back to when you finished. So, you grew up here, you studied in Wollongong, but you were quite a talented sportsman. So you were a professional rugby league player.
Yeah, I did that.
How did that? So tell us all about that and what you learned from being a professional sportsman.
Oh, I learned quite a lot, actually. I think it was probably set me up for life in many facets of what you do in sort of being dedicated and committed to something. I loved playing rugby league since I was five. You know, quite a young age in getting involved and played a year ahead of myself in those early years. Yeah, just grew up and loved playing the game, loved watching the game. It was something my dad and I did quite a lot, and it was really enjoyed going to the footy, watching the footy with my father. And yeah, just about 16, 17, I think I was playing Commonwealth Bank Cup for my school, you know, the schoolboy telly stuff, which is a bit exciting. And then got picked up by Parramatta. Yeah. Wow. So they graded me early, where you go through like the SG ball and Jersey flag, which is sort of lower grades. And then we used to have an under 21s back then and a reserve grade and then first grade. I didn't play first grade for Parra. I moved on to Balmain before I did that, and then played for Balmain with played with Parramatta firstly with some greats, you know, Peter Stirlings, the Brett Kennys and all those sort of guys. And then moved on to Balmain and, yeah, had the chance to run around with the likes of Blocker, Benny Elias and Paul Sirenin, all those sort of guys, Dave Brooks.
And Parramatta was your schoolboy? I mean, that was the club you...
That was the club I went for as a schoolboy, yeah.
That must have been nice.
Oh, it was awesome.
Yeah.
There was nothing like pulling on that jersey, as they say, first time on, running on the field. I mean, nothing beats the adrenaline rush you get when you run onto the field and have... 40,000 people wow. cheering. I miss that every day, but you never get it back, no matter how hard you try, with all the sort of...
And was that the highlight? You know, because, I mean, I did a little bit of sport and rode in the boat race once, and I remember sitting in the start line thinking that, you know, I wonder if this is going to be the highlight of my life. And in some ways it was.
Yeah, it's a highlight in a different... I think you have different types of highlights, right? You know, like when your first child is born is... You know, you never beat that moment yeah. either, but you sort of can't compare. Like it's very much I think visceral is the right word I'm looking for. Like it's just, you just feel it. Like, you know, the exhilaration of running out and being part of a team in particular is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that you're out there, you're not comrades, you're not army, you know, you're not in the army and you're not killing people and trying to save each other's life, but you have this real commitment to each other, which yeah. is you're in the same team, you look after each other, you're there to do a task and you work together to do that. And then, you know, going back to your original question around what did you learn, I mean, it's all about teamwork, right?
Yeah.
That was a big start to that.
And league doesn't, I mean, maybe this is unfair and you can maybe correct this, but I mean, league doesn't seem as educated, if that's the word, as union. Is that true or is it not true? I mean, is the fact that, you know, because you...
Depends on whether you're from Australia or New Zealand, but right. with all due respect, but it was funny, Sonny Bill Williams came out with a quote today. He had something in the paper the other day where he said if rugby is going to survive, they need to get into the public schools,
right.
Whereas rugby is generally in Australia is for private schools or played in private schools.
Yeah.
Rugby league is a different socioeconomic, there's no doubt about that. I am from the western suburbs, you know, and proud of the fact that I've, you know, got to where I am from fairly humble beginnings. But... You know, I think you can't tar everyone with the same brush, so to speak, just because they're a rugby league player. And unfortunately, a lot of them do get that. And there are guys in there who just do the wrong thing, right?
Yeah.
It's that simple.
Yeah, that's probably completely unfair, and that's why I wanted you to defend it. So. Yeah, and there are some, like my son is just finishing at King's, and I remember I picked him up one day and I saw this guy that he looked like a car. I mean, he was a monster. He was about 6'4". What's his name? Joseph Suvalu?
Oh, yeah. He's huge.
Yeah, yeah. And like, he's about to go on a sort of $2 million a year contract with the Roosters and, you know, but he's a Kings. I mean, it's a good school. And I mean, is that normal that you get someone that young? And
it's becoming more normal. Right. Yeah. Particularly the scouts are getting better and picking players a lot younger. They're really picking athletes more so than anything, you know.
Right.
And, you know, since I stopped playing, it became a professional sport. Like it was still a part-time sport when I was playing. But I finished in 93 and I think it was 96 or 97 where players became full-time players, right?
Yeah.
And even though it was professional back there, but it was part-time. You still had to have a job, you know. I worked in quite a few, you know, sales rep jobs to make sure I could keep living, but because I wasn't getting paid as much as the players are today. But it's very much a professional sport, and like I said, they're picking them young, they're picking athletes, and they're training every day, three times a day. So, yeah. And then if you look at the size of players and the, how fit they are these days, it's very different to what it was.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, they do look incredible. They're just amazing athletes. Yeah. All right, let's not go too far down the sport rabbit hole. I love talking about it. And,
so do I. So. I know. Get stuck.
I want to touch on your, I do research before any of these interviews, and I went through your LinkedIn profile, which is always a good place to go. And it's one of the most interesting LinkedIn profiles I think I've ever seen. And I think partly that was because you had some interesting jobs as you were playing rugby. So, you were Unilever Streets ice cream rep. You owned a cafe in North Cronulla. You were at the Piccadilly Theatre.
Yeah.
I love this one. You were a voiceover artist for Rhubarb Rhubarb. Tell us about, well, I'll pause there and you can tell us about Rhubarb Rhubarb.
Yeah, sure. Look, it really stemmed from the Piccadilly. So when I jumped into running a cafe kiosk down in Cronulla, I did that for a year, and at the end of that year, I said, "This is not for me," and didn't really know where I was going. And it is something that I want to talk about, and I like to really jump into as far as mental health after finishing professional sport, because. Yeah. You do get a bit lost, right? And then I was lost. I was sort of...
It's very common.
Yeah, absolutely. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and I was sort of trying different things. And when you dedicate yourself to a sport like that and then you sort of spat out the other side. I was lucky I had an education. I had a university degree, and not everyone does, right? Yeah. So, but I still lost, because you live in this bubble, and then bang, you're thrown out into the real world, and... you got to find your way. So,
and you go from being top of the pops, top of king of the castle, running out in front of 40,000 people who love you, to being just a regular Joe.
A regular Joe, exactly. And so I was searching around and found the kiosk on the back of my Streets ice cream days. Knew that they sold lots of ice cream, so I bought the kiosk and did that for a year and hated that with a passion. So then I was like, I don't know what to do. So we just went traveling. I sold the kiosk, used the money with my wife.
You married? Yeah, great.
Yeah. And we went and lived over in London we committed to living in London for, we didn't know how long. We just went over there and did the usual Australian thing and got our visa and jumped in, backpacked around Europe for 3 months, and then came back from there. And my brother had a friend who was running the Piccadilly Theatre. And he said, "You go and get a job there. It's fun." And it was easily the best time of my life. I got to say, we had a ball. I was working backstage there, and also front of house, and just being around artists and actors. And one of them said to me one time, "Oh, you've got a great voiceover voice. You should do voiceover." And that was it. It was like I can't remember the name of the magazine. I think it was called The Stage or something. It was the sort of magazine that was sort of hung around Piccadilly Theatre, and there was one ad there that says, "Do your voiceover tape," and I just went and did it. And then all of a sudden I was doing voiceovers in London.
Wow. And, yeah, so, like, give us a – you've got a nice mic in front of you, so give us your best voiceover for an ad you did.
Oh, God. Well, I'll give you background to the ad really quickly. It was for the Bank of Scotland.
No, there we go. Yeah. Hopefully you're an Aussie.
Talking to Skippy, believe it or not. So it was like, "Oh, what's up, Skip? Oh, my God. I can't believe the bridge has fallen down. What's happening? Oh now what are they going to do with their mortgage? Oh, they've got to go to the Bank of Scotland." Something like that. It was something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was. But here I was talking to Skip, and I forgot to put in the because that was in there as well.
Did that last long?
Look, it was great. It was great because I just did it part-time, right? And did the ad last long? I'm not entirely sure, but as far as me doing voiceover was concerned, it was great. I did probably about half a dozen ads or so, if not more, but I was always getting paid royalties, which was fantastic. I think I got an enormous amount of money for an hour's work. But I did that sort of while I was back, in between backpacking and come back. And then I wanted to do that back here in Australia. And believe it or not, that's how it sort of led to me doing internet stuff, which which was whilst I was doing voiceover, I'm looking over to the left and I'm seeing a sound engineer. And I'm thinking, hey, maybe that's a good job to become a sound engineer. And I wrote back to my mate in Australia and said, can you find me a sound engineering course? I'm keen to come back and do that. And there's a college called Sound SAE, I can't remember what that stands for, School of Audio Engineering, I think it is. And they were offering for the first time a multimedia certificate or something.
Right.
And my mate sent that back and he said, no, you should do this, Steve. This is you. And that's what happened.
Wow. Yeah, because that was back in the – let's remember that. Yeah, yeah. It was
1997.
EMEA, you know, so the Australian Interactive Multimedia Industry Association. I mean, that's where I think you and I first hung out. Absolutely. And had a few drinks. I mean, and that literally started by posting CD-ROMs to people.
Yeah, well, that's what I used to program CD-ROMs. That's
So tell us about those early days of going from, you know, CD-ROM to, you know, because you ran digital agencies and then you're involved in, you know, your own agency. And yeah, so tell us about that first part of the journey before Blue Freeway.
Yeah, so coming out of the course.
Not Blue Freeway. What did I say that for?
Mass media. Yeah. We'll get to Blue Freeway, sure. But coming out of the course, you know, it's very early days for internet. And so anyone with any experience whatsoever could get a job. And I basically got picked up by an ad agency called Brand Dialogue. It was part of Y&R actually. And we were doing loads of things like banner ads and microsites and things like that. And I was doing design and development. I was a flash developer back then as well as doing CD-ROMs and things like that. But I was really bored with the fact that you weren't actually building applications, right? You know, building technology to do stuff. It was very much advertising taken off magazines and thrown onto a computer. It wasn't really much more than that. So that's why I started my own company, which was Mass Media Studios. It was all about trying to build products, technology products. And I started, I think it was the month it all went pear-shaped.
Yeah, 2000, wasn't it?
2000, yeah. I think it was March or April 2000. Can't remember the exact date. And that was so, there was, you know, we were riding the massive wave of the dot-com boom, and then it busted around about exactly the same time. Now, you know, I had so many people in my ear telling me, you shouldn't do that now. You shouldn't go and jump into this now. The internet's dead, right? You know,
it's never going to work.
And I said, look, I'm committed. I'm going, you know. And it turned out to be probably the best time to do it, to be honest, because resources were cheap and people were getting, you know, let go, and big companies like Spike and there was another one, I can't recall the name of it, but the big Spike in particular, who'd hired probably hundreds of developers and designers, and they basically shut down. So here is, you know, the market's full of people who could who are relatively cheap and needed work, unlike today's resources. But so it was probably a good time to start off Mass Media, and that's what kicked it off. And we started building products as well as doing the advertising and stuff. But it was really, you know, we had products for real estate and CMS systems, and eventually we built another product, which Traction, which is our sort of trophy product that became
software. It was SaaS before SaaS was a thing,
exactly.
Wasn't it? Yeah, I remember that. It's a great product.
So it was marketing automation. Yeah. So before there was marketing automation.
Yeah. And so, you were one of the pioneers of this industry. And I've said to other people, I guess I kind of was too, with, you know, we're trying to do video platforms. I mean, the pioneers get the arrows in the back. And it wasn't all plain sailing. There was no funding. There was no ecosystem. It was a different time. But you learned a hell of a lot. I mean, absolutely. That's really, I think, equipped you to have gone through, you know, the last few years. So I mean, let's maybe fast forward to sort of the end of Mass Media. Maybe we can touch on Blue Freeway and why you wanted to get out and do your own thing after that again.
After Mass Media?
Yeah.
There was an interesting experience, obviously, going through the whole sale of the, you know, Mass Media and Traction. There was a spin-off business, which was 2&2, which is now evolved into Cognos. But I took some time off, right? You know, it was great. You know, how long was I doing it for? 10 years. And, you know, I obviously made a bit of money in the sale, and it was just time to chill. I ended up building a house, which was and became the project manager of that because the builder went bust. So that was an experience and a half too, right? You know, here I am literally becoming a tradie. Well, not a tradie as such, but someone just helping them out, you know, carrying bags of cement up and downstairs and things like that. But I ended up building the house, and that was a real eye-opener for me as well, because it made me realize that some of the skills that I'd learned in building a company and project managing projects, I could apply to anything, right? And that's when I just, you feel, you sort of get this, not invincible, but you have this level of confidence that you can really do anything. I don't necessarily need to know the industry. I can build a product to suit an industry. I don't necessarily need to have the experience in the industry. We'll talk about that with Drive Yellow. Like, you know, it's not like I've been in logistics all my life.
Yeah.
So, you know, that initial period was just, hey, take some time off, went traveling with the family and stuff. And I started getting interested in trying to do something for consumer, and apps were starting to boom, right? Apps on, obviously driven by iPhone and the Google Play stores, et cetera. So I decided to try to think of an idea came to me about how can I make a virtual incubator. And incubators were starting to pick up around then. And that's where App Village idea came to me. And you basically could submit an idea. Everyone had an app idea, right?
You know, yeah.
They wanted an idea developed and not really a place where they could go to do that back then. So that's what App Village was. You could submit your idea. We would assess it. If we liked your idea, we'd find an investor for it. We'd find some designers and developers to do it. And we'd pay you a royalty if it was just your idea. So everything was based on royalties, you know, 10% for your idea. It was 20% for design. So everyone had skin in the game, whoever was in it. Unless an investor came and put money in, then they would buy those resources.
Yeah.
And that was awesome. That was just amazing fun. But it didn't make any money, so it didn't last long. It lasted about a year or so. But then I was also did a bit of work with a good mutual friend of ours, Nick Bolton.
Yeah.
And we were doing some short films and stuff. That was the sort of a creative side coming out, and enjoyed that as well, but also found it really tough raising money for that sort of stuff here in Australia. So
yeah, it's a tough business. He's gone on. He's done well.
So no, he's done amazing. I don't
know if he listens to this podcast, but yeah, Nick's a great guy. Love him.
And eventually just the idea of Drive Yellow came about through talking to the co-founder at the time, as he had a problem. He owned a couple of pizza joints, and this is before Uber Eats and Deliveroo, et cetera, were here.
Yeah, so we're no back, 2014. I mean, this is a sort of genesis. So, I mean, this is a good story. And so I just started at AWS at the time.
That's right.
I can remember.
And you helped us out.
Yeah, we did. Oh, hopefully. We helped a lot of people out.
Yeah, absolutely.
yeah, so, I mean, and you went through the Qantas Accelerator, and then, I mean, like.
No, it wasn't Qantas. So the first one we did was Mira D.
That's right.
And I was actually a mentor there for a couple of years and liked what they were doing and thought it would be good for our early team to be part of that. You know, Mick Lubinskas used to work with me at Mass Media as well many moons ago, and talking to him and he agreed it probably would be a good thing to do. So we jumped into that, and that's what helped kickstart Drive Yellow. And then we also did another accelerator with Slingshot, which is but that was more of a corporate sponsored one, which was with Lion Breweries.
I thought it was because they had Qantas as well.
They had Qantas as well,
right. So you didn't do that one as
Lion? No, I didn't do that
right.
one.
Okay, I got it wrong. Sorry.
That's all right. Lion, so we did the Lion one, and Lion ended up being an investor in our business and was also helping us generate business. They were utilizing us, I should say, out of one of their breweries in Perth and giving that a go, and also Malt Shovel used us as well. So that helped us through the lean years. I mean, it's been...
Because there were some lean years. I mean, I think you're in a good spot now, but I mean, let's not sugarcoat this. You had, you know, 3, 4, 5 pretty tough years with this business.
Absolutely. Look, really quickly, you know, a gig economy business needs scale to survive. You need network effect. You need... Yep. And you're not profitable from day one. This just doesn't happen. So you need to have funding. And we really struggled to get the level of funding that we needed to scale. We sort of got those initial, you know, $300K and $1 million, and that sort of got us going. But I find that there is not a great deal of support, although I think that's changing here in Australia. But back then, there wasn't a great deal of support for that next level, the scaling up, and particularly in the sort of industry we're talking about. You know, like to date, we've only raised $11.5 million. The similar companies elsewhere are in the hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, right? So that's always been a struggle, and we've just, you know, fought our way through. There was a time where there was at least three or four times where we pretty close to being insolvent. One in particular time we were actually in safe harbor, so we were ready to close doors. And
I think so. I wanted to jump in that story because I think it was just before that you joined the Summit, group. Club, yeah. You know, which is, you know, for those that don't know, it's the Innovation Bay's late stage founder group, and you know, some amazing people in there, and it's all about peer to peer support and learning. You know, so the idea is to bring help, you know, get founders to help other people. The first event, or maybe it's the second one you came to. So February 2020, I remember it. You know, because you can get visceral, and I have checked that, you know, you're okay telling the story, because normally like what goes on in those meetings is super confidential, but I checked and it's okay. But like your mom had just died, which was horrible for you, and your company was on its knees. I mean, I think this is when you were in safe harbor, and you know, you were in pieces. I mean, it was just it was hard to watch, because you know, I'd known you for so long, and you know, I cared, and it was a really tough time, and we're all looking at each other going, fucking hell, this is like, and at that point, there's not much you can do except pat you on the head and say, we're here, they're there. 1 month, I mean, like maybe you could take the story from there, because it was an amazing turnaround.
Yeah, look, that was a pretty tough time, I have to say, and probably the most stressful time as far as any my experience in business was during that period. But then, believe it or not, something happened to the world, which was COVID, and then all of a sudden the market here woke up and realized that that's what we actually need, is people to help businesses deliver.
Right? Yeah, it's funny, when you're stuck at home, you kind of need people to deliver stuff to you.
Yeah, and basically I think we grew like 300% in about 3 months or something. You know, so the exact numbers off the top of my head in that period was just crazy. It was crazy time.
And at what moment did you realize that was going to be, you know, that was the inflection point or the change that you needed?
Oh, look, we were sort of always waiting for an inflection point. We thought the inflection point was going to come with Amazon coming here.
Yep.
And that was going to force retailers to get their you know, shit together, for want of a better description. But what it ended up doing was, it was COVID. It was, because what happened is consumer behavior changed, literally changed overnight. You know, you've got people who never ordered online are now ordering online on a regular basis, and shops were closed, and there was no other option to service their customers other than doing delivery. So both consumer behavior change happened, as well as retailers getting prepared and putting the systems in place to enable this type of delivery, which is from the retail store to the home, not necessarily from a central warehouse anymore. So that's what we needed as a business. We needed more retailers and more consumers demanding that, either that fast delivery or retailers having the systems in place to enable them to do that. And that was really the kicker. And we were getting so much inbound over that period to say, hey, we need help doing delivery, as well as we deliver anything these days, but you know, we started off in the food space, but we sort of massive resurgence in the food space as well, because you had a lot of restaurants who were closing down unless they could do delivery, and some of them have never done delivery before. Yeah. You know, even the Merivale group, you know, some of those guys, some of the restaurants that they have don't do delivery. And they needed it literally overnight, and we helped them do that. And we were quite proud of what we did as a business to not only enable businesses to survive, but just understanding how our business literally scaled, tenfold in a very, very, very fast period of time. And as well, not only that, we were just in Sydney and Melbourne primarily. And literally within 3 months, we're delivering nationwide.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So, but that must have been, I mean, really difficult in a very different way. I mean, this, you know, high quality problems like that one are still problems.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, you've got inbound customers that you're probably having to push away in some cases. You've got to find drivers and that whole logistics piece. I'm sure, you know, your systems and software maybe was a bit clunky and needed some help, yet you still didn't have a huge amount of funding and you need to hire staff. I mean, what was the, tell us about some of the hard points in that.
Oh, look, I can't speak highly enough of the team at the time. We were all working from home, so that was an additional issue that we had to deal with, that everyone's working from home, working long hours. And we were just committed. We were excited by it, though. We were excited by what was happening, because some of the vision that we'd had for it, our business and our product and everything else, was coming to fruition, right? You know, it was happening for us. And you have to understand, like, the quality of the delivery just improves dramatically the more drivers that are on the system, obviously, and the more orders that are going through it. So we, you know, here we were telling investors how it's going to go just crazy and we'll be able to cope. And they're going, oh, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. And then we go, shit, see, we told you this is what would happen, right? And it did. And it was just this sort of validation time and period that was just quite exciting, you know, from that perspective. But look, the team really worked hard. We were still a very small team. We didn't hire 20 people overnight either. Like, we were still just after safe harbor. So we had let people go. Like, we were down to 15, 16 people. And, you know, with a team over in the Philippines as well. But it literally just coped. And we were running off adrenaline, really. A lot of us were just, this was an exciting time. It was one of those, you know, it's like, you know what it's like when you're starting a business and stuff just happens because you're just going off adrenaline, and that's what was happening.
And it's amazing how lean you can be in those early days and you need to be. And then, you know, as you get older and bigger and fatter, it's like, hang on, like, we used to do this with half a person. Maybe it wasn't that well.
Well, there is the burnout factor, right? You know, so, and that did happen as well. There's a few people just went, this is too hard. You know, and it wasn't until just post that where we raised a bit more money, which was great. And that helped, that allowed us to, we also became profitable. Now, so, you know, in October, what is it, 2020, was the first time we were actually cash flow neutral.
So good.
And, you know, for a company like ours to be cash flow neutral, that's almost unheard of. Right? So, so we were quite proud of that. And admittedly, it wasn't sustainable because we needed to hire more people. And we did. And we got some funding, but we just continued to grow. So we didn't see it sort of drop off the edge when everything opened up in, you know, late 2020. It dipped a little bit. It was about 5% dip, but we just seen it grow because we brought on so many more clients that, and they were getting the service, and all of a sudden it just continued to grow. And of course we had another kick with this second wave. But we see the same thing sort of happening. We're seeing a little bit of a dip. Now that people are going to open up, we'll see a little bit of a dip, but we don't see it going backwards by any stretch.
I mean, where are you at on the investment and funding front? So, like,
we're pretty active. We're out there, you know, if you look at our industry, there's a lot of investment, and, you know, the likes of Zoom2U have had an IPO recently, and it's been relatively successful, although albeit small, but still very successful.
So, and Zoom2U is a courier company.
Yeah, they're similar to us. It's crowd-based courier platform, but they were traditionally more a courier company in the past. I think they're moving more to a platform play. But they have, like I said, IPO'd recently. There's a lot of interest in, you see a lot of these 15-minute grocery delivery companies that have come out,
Milk Run.
Milk Run and all these sort of guys. Good luck getting 15 minutes, having done grocery for 2 years. I think they're dreaming. But
Zoom2U, like, I mean, the numbers around that are pretty amazing. I mean, what is it, $1.5 million revenue, $80 million valuation?
Something along those lines, yeah.
That's pretty high.
Very high.
I mean, like, this is not financial advice here, but that's, I don't know, is that sustainable? I mean, like.
I don't think it is, but they're riding the wave. It's not dissimilar to Get Swift, if you remember back in the day. I can't comment on their business too much, but like I know that this business or this industry is something that's going to continue to grow because I think we're only really scratching the surface at the moment. If you compare what can get delivered and the amount of retailers who deliver in Australia versus overseas, it's very different, and the experience is still very different. Still a long way to go yet.
Yeah, I think. Well, I think the opportunity is huge, and that's probably what's being priced in there. I mean, if they're growing at, I don't know what their numbers are, but 100% a year, and it's the market's billions of dollars, then sure, there's some justification.
Well, year on year, we grew 300%, right? You know, so that's a pretty massive growth from the two financial years.
Let's talk a little bit about the gig economy, because I mean that's kind of the sweet spot that you're in. And it's you'll know the numbers, and I'll maybe ask you about them. Like, what percentage of the Australian workforce is a gig economy worker?
I don't know that number, so I'm glad.
But it's high.
it is. It's a growing number for sure, right? And particularly what's happened over during the COVID period, we were an essential service, and we provided a platform to enable independent contractors to build their own delivery business over that period. And it really saved people's lives in some cases. You know, like they wouldn't have had an income if it wasn't, or revenue if it wasn't for platforms like ours. And it's a growing, gig is like, I can't remember the stats off the top of my head, but actually Prof G, someone I listened to on a podcast, and he was talking about how I think it was 50-60% of all work will be gig economy in a decade's time or something along those lines, and it will just change. And that means it doesn't necessarily mean everyone's a delivery driver. It could be a lawyer who's working in a gig type. They're not necessarily working for a firm. They're working in providing a service in a gig type fashion. There's a lot that needs to happen in Australia to make this make it work a little better than what it is, and we need to get laws straightened out to enable a clear definition of what a gig economy worker is versus a contractor versus a casual versus an employee.
Yeah, because that's murky right now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very murky, and what it does is it creates confusion. There's no black and white answer, and therefore, you can have the powers that be going after companies like ours and then we have to defend it in court, and we may end up winning the case, but we've also spent 5 or 6 years spending a lot of money trying to defend ourselves. And we know of companies that have done that in the past, and they've been successful in the end, but very distracting.
Yeah, and when you're the size of Deliveroo or Uber Eats, you employ legal counsel. You've got 10 lawyers on your staff. Yeah. You, I suspect, don't have 10 lawyers.
No, we don't have 10 lawyers. we do obviously have a law firm. We work with Minters and Mark Lawyers, and they've been really good to us. But there have been times where I think we'll probably have to amp it up if we ever get caught in that sort of world. But it's a very stressful part of running a business like this. It doesn't need to be. It doesn't have to be like this. There is a simple answer, and it's just about the powers that be pulling the fingers out and making the laws and legislating about what type of worker is a gig economy and what are their rights. Because it's not like we want to break the law.
Yeah,
we're just working what we see as being within the confines of the law, and we just have to argue that our view is different to the ATO's or Fair Work's view, and why should we have to do that if we know it's going to exist? It's not going away. So let's put some laws in place that make it really clear for everybody.
And it sounds like it's the laws that have to change. I mean, the bureaucrats are just doing their job, so if they're working at the ATO, then, your job is to enforce what's done by the politicians. So, I mean, do you think there's a gap? I mean, like, we're on our seventh innovation minister from this current government, and it's like we are an afterthought, which gives me gives me the shits a bit. I mean, any views on that and what the current government should be doing?
Look, we're also you know, working with the Australian New Established Tech Council as well to maybe help us through this process.
Have they been helpful?
They have. I mean, Grant McCarthy, who's a director of mine, has been communicating to them. And, you know, we're looking to try and get some change because it is about just clarity. It's the grey area that's the problem. That's the key issue here.
Yeah. I mean, jumping back to that, I mean, I'm just trying to extract as many lessons as we can from that moment. You know, the one thing I wrote down before I did it is, you know, this phrase, it's always darkest before the dawn. Mm-hmm. Like every startup is in some painful scenario. Some of them could be, you know, life-threatening in that sense. I mean, where you were at, you know, a year ago last February was definitely life-threatening for the business. I mean, is that accurate? It's always darkest before the dawn, or is that just a bit cliched?
I don't think it's cliched, but it's also about just keep going, right? You know, if you survive, you find a way to make it work. You know, we could have just given up and said it's too hard, and we would have been finished. Right?
Yeah.
And going back to the sport analogies and the lessons through sport, that's what I was taught to do.
Yeah.
Get knocked down, get back up, don't look hurt. That was it. You know, so I think I apply that mentality to pretty much everything I do. It's like, you know, and don't get me wrong, there are days that are on a personal level can be quite dark, and I've got people who are around me that support me, obviously my family in particular, my wife, Linda. But, you know, there are people outside of my family like Grant and Patrick Llewellyn's a great friend of mine who's CEO of 99 Designs.
Yeah, he's been on the podcast twice.
Oh,
is that your ambition?
No, only joking, Patrick. You know, he's a guy I call regularly. He's very supportive. And as I said, Grant, and also Craig Galvin, who currently works in our business, is another guy. So these are all people who, you have to have people around you that you can just go, I feel like shit today and this is the problem. Help me get through it.
Yeah. Right?
And the Summit Club has obviously been that as well. You know, we had a business issue that was really quite stressful, and the first group of people I reached out to was my Green Clan.
Yeah.
And, you know, Rob from there, he really helped out in introducing me to someone who could potentially help us out, and you had two or three people just sort of, you know, automatically sending us a message of support, you know. Yeah. So having that group of people within the Summit Club has been very helpful as well.
Yeah. Maybe there's the last topic and then we'll do the quick fire round, but I mean, what's next? I mean, you've got through the, you know, this dark phase. I mean, I think you now have levers to pull and you've got revenue. Yep. And you know, it seems like it's you're on a high, but yeah, what are your future plans?
Yeah, so we're excited about what's possible for Drive Yellow. We're talking to a couple of companies at the moment that we're looking to work closer to get together, and we're
investment or customers, partnerships?
Partnerships, yeah. But we have to raise some what we could consider to be serious money. You know, like I said, we've raised $11 million over 7 years. That's not a lot, right? It's trickled in. So we've got to go for a 10 mil and then a 40 and then a $50 million round or something along those lines, where we can really take not only what business we have today and really fulfill our vision, which is around the most intelligent gig economy platform, and take it international, with a pure tech play, which is something that we're hoping to do in the next, raising money, our initial round in the next 3 months or so, at least getting some commitments and lead up to Christmas. But, and we're in, you know, deep conversations as it is, but then also looking for a much bigger round next year.
All right. So more money in, hire out your tech team, bolster the tech, scale.
I mean, is that absolutely
kind of the punchline? Yeah. I mean, it sounds easy, doesn't it?
I don't know why more people don't do it.
All right. Well, look, I think, Steve, that was awesome. You know, I always learn lots from doing this. And look, thanks for sharing. No, I appreciate it. I mean, it was a tough story a year ago last February. So
that's for sure.
Important to get that out. All right, look, why don't we jump to the quickfire round and see what we can or learn from you there. So what have you got, a book recommendation?
Yeah, Fanocracy is my book. It's all about creating your fans into customers and customers into fans, and it's something we live by at Drive Yellow, so check it out.
Have you bought a copy for all of your staff?
Everyone gets one.
Is that like the first
It's the thing that sits on their desk when they walk in.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, absolutely, because he explains it better than I do, but, you know, so I really want everyone to buy into the ethos of it, you know, which is what do we need to do to get people talking about our business and talking about it in a very favorable fashion.
Yeah. Podcast, do you have a favorite podcast?
Yeah, Prof. G podcast, I mentioned that earlier. Professor Galloway, he's a smart guy.
He's a professor at New York Uni, is it?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. And I actually just did his brand strategy course through Section 4. He's got a really cool course there and found it to be awesome. And we'll be taking out the business through that in a couple of weeks, so that'll be good.
Great.
But he it's quite, you know, it's startup centric, but it's also investment advice and just general news. It's really good.
He's pretty good. He's active on the podcast platform. He does Pivot, I think.
Pivot as well,
Kara Swisher. Yeah. And that's pretty entertaining. Yeah. I mean, because the two of them just, they let loose. I mean, they swear and they, you know, they sledge people and they're just, they don't hold back.
No, they're very good. I like it. He's a great presenter / podcast.
Yeah, right. Do you have a favorite news source? Like, where do you catch up in things?
I don't really, to be honest, news sources are challenging at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, not many people are believing in them, and there are things that people are putting out there that are unbelievable as well. You know, so I sort of, my news source is listening to podcasts and hearing things and then doing my own sort of, I won't call it research, but, you know, investigation around what's true and what's not, and looking online as much as I can to validate what I think is reality.
Yeah. But, not everything online is true, Steve.
No, I know. But I do my best.
Hopefully, the balance of truth is there.
With
any luck. That's fair enough. Do you have a favorite tech CEO?
Yeah, look, I just admire what the Atlassian guys are doing, particularly with this recent investment announcement in clean tech. And I think what they're doing is really...
The Solar City. I mean, that's a $30 billion. I mean, it's like a massive battery. Well, it's not a battery, but it's a power plant.
Oh, but also I think he's put some funding into helping fund clean tech startups as well, right?
Yeah. He's done a lot.
Yeah. You know, so he's putting money where his mouth is, and I think that's admirable. And they've built a massive business, right?
Yeah.
You know, I've got shares in them, and it's grown 100% in 6 months as far as the share price is concerned.
It topped 100 billion, didn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. So I mean, that's enormous. Yeah.
And he was he's an Aussie battler, I don't know about battler, but he was an Aussie.
He's a lovely guy.
Yeah, no, he is. But I was just,
If you bump into him, this is Mike. I mean, if you bump into him in the street, you wouldn't believe, and you didn't know who he was, you wouldn't believe he's a billionaire. I mean, he's got a scraggy beard and looks a little unkempt,
good luck to him.
Super smart and just so passionate. It's great. Favorite TV show or even movie you can have?
Yeah, look, actually, been watching. I think Ted Lasso is actually my favorite TV show. It's an Apple TV Plus show. If you haven't seen it, it is maybe I was attracted to it because of the sport association, but it's just a really good feel good TV series.
Yeah.
And you know, we've watched it with the family. And my daughter loves it, and it's just something that's really good to watch, and you feel good after it. And then what else can you ask for?
Squid Game. Did you watch Squid Game?
I did.
It's maybe not feel good.
No, but it's interesting. I had a discussion with Julie Trell, who's ex-Mira D, about this, because she was quite depressed about what that meant about society. And I really struggled. I watched the first episode and then didn't turn it back on for a few days. And I thought, I'll give it another shot.
Yeah.
And And I got through it. And then in the end, I actually, it made me reflect on everything about what's happening, even with the pandemic, with whatever, and just about how, you know, are we really making the right decisions? You know, obviously it is an anti-capitalist sort of sentiment, yeah. You know, and, you know, are we making the right decisions at a lower level to actually, you know, will we end up there is probably the question.
Yes, it's tough to talk about it without giving the plot spoilers. But
exactly.
I mean, it's kind of like the Hunger Games, but
on a different level. Yeah, but it is like the Hunger Games. It is the Korean version of the Hunger Games.
Yeah, it's a much more warped version of the Hunger Games. I mean, it is. Yeah.
But some of the decision, I found myself really asking myself, what would I do in that situation? And, you know, I really struggled with the answer.
Yeah. You know? No, it's
particularly one of the games towards the end there, which I won't give it away, but the one where there was two of them, and you start thinking, God, I feel like a new bastard. Like, you know, I know.
Yeah, no, like, I don't watch a huge amount of telly, but I definitely got quite riveted by that. I thought it was great. All right. Do you have a productivity tool that you use or recommend?
Yeah, we use a lot of platforms at Drive Yellow, and look, you know, the usual ones, the Asana is for project management, and Slack is something we almost live in. But we discovered a new tool recently, which is called Trainual or Trainual, T-R-A-I-N-U-A-L. And I've just found it to be really useful in collating and communicating, as well as testing training material for your staff, onboarding. So we use it for anything now. Like, you know, if someone's got a good idea, they put it up there. There's some voting capabilities. Or, you know, as soon as someone comes on board, we ask them for suggestions of what's missing from it. So, okay, yes, we'll write a blog post if you want, for one of a better description in there. So it's just been a really good onboarding and training tool, and I found it great from a CEO perspective, in that, you know, being a smaller company and that's just exploded, you know, some of the stuff is still in my head, right? So I've gone through the process of getting it out of my head and putting it not on paper but online, and therefore, not many people need to come to me and ask how to do something anymore, which is great.
Well, that's awesome. All right, last question. Favorite app on your phone?
Yeah, look, I probably visit the apps that I visit the most are probably my investment apps. Are Stake. I really like Stake because I can invest in US stocks. It's apparently they're opening up the ASX now as well. But I'm really enjoying the Apple Fitness app, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
And the video sessions that they have.
So beyond just the step count, I mean,
they've got a lot of content. So it's a little bit like Peloton. In fact, there's rumors around Apple buying Peloton, isn't there, or something?
Not sure.
But, you know, so it's a bit like that. But what it's really enabled us to do, I got a daughter who lives down in Canberra going to uni, and, you know, we get up every morning and train together and watch the same vid, and, you know, it's a good way of connecting and keeping each other fit. So it's good.
That's great. But you're looking fit. This is good.
Oh, thank you.
Lockdown's been good for you.
I don't know about that. Too much chocolate and biscuits at 6 o'clock at night.
All right, last question. If you got asked to do a TED talk, what would you talk about?
I talk about the mental health of CEOs, particularly startup CEOs, I think. Yep. You know, there's a lot of talk about it these days, but I think there's a lot of there can be a lot of work that can be done, and it's tough. Yeah. It's actually really tough, and particularly when you go through times like, you know, safe harbors and you might have personal stuff going on at the time or dealing with, you know, arbitration or whatever it is you're dealing with, you know. So I think I would do something around that and how to manage that, you know. That would be my go-to.
Yeah, and, you know, almost specifically for athletes. I mean, there's actually there's a buddy. Oh, he's not a buddy, but I know him, and he's launched a charity called Crossing the Line, which is for retired athletes, because the prevalence of depression in retired athletes is massive.
No, it's huge.
You know, and he was an Olympic rower, and, you know, I think he won a medal, and then he comes out of that, and, you know, you're regular Joe, and you don't have a purpose, and it's just bloody hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard for every tech CEO, don't get me wrong,
No, but it's really
such a big issue.
Well, it's funny you should say that. I think I might have mentioned to you this once before, but I was speaking to our director, Grant, the other day, and I said, look, when this is all over, like, you know, when I've got a bit more time, there's nothing I would love more to do is to work with athletes to help them have something after the game, right? You know, maybe that's what you call it, you know, some sort of after the game program, right? Because they honestly just get thrown on the heap, you know. And not all of them are suitable to running businesses or whatever, but it's just preparing them for life after sport and have, you know, I suppose I can relate to it. You know, I was by no means a regular first grader or anything, where some of these guys have got nothing else but first grade for 10, 12 years of their life, and then, you know, the switch is turned off and then bang, they've got nothing.
Yeah. Right?
So, you know, I'd love to be able to help with that.
Yeah. No, that's great. Steve, thank you. I should let you get catch up with your family again. But look, thanks for coming around the house. It was nice to see you. And thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you in the next one.